Hey, welcome everyone to Rainmaker Power Hour, the Global Billionaire Rainmaker channel. We are here every Tuesday live on Chatter, and we also stream on X and YouTube. Definitely give us a follow on our YouTube channel. That's Global Billionaire Rainmakers. Every week, we bring on entrepreneurs from all different parts of the world and different stories that come along with it. We're going to learn from them. How did they get to where they're at? The story behind it and the journey behind it. So I'm going to hand this over to my co-host, Macy, so that she can talk about our sponsor. Go ahead, Macy.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. You guys, I do not have a pair of shoes this time to hold up because it's not on. I had the pythons are so hot. Somebody took them and now they're wearing them on the course. My shoes are gone this time. William and Harry Golf. It is absolutely where luxury and comfort meet. I have to admit, I don't play golf as much as I would like to, but I just wear them because they are fabulous. WilliamandHarry.com. If you know, you know. So go check them out. We're going to put them up so you can click on the link here shortly. But if you want to be a conversation starter on a night out or on the course, get you somewhere. William and Harry, push the order button because they do sell out pretty quick. My favorites are the pythons, but again, check out all of them. Thank you, William and Harry, for always bringing your end game.
All right. Thank you. So, guys, tonight we have the one and only Nitin joining us. For those of you that do not know Nitin, he's originally from India, moved to the U.S. when he was 17 years old, went to Purdue University and studied industrial engineering, went on to co-found Sabre Software, that grew to a company with over 1,200 employees, $300 million in revenue, and he sold that company for $470 million. So most people would retire after that, but no. Then went on to start a tech investment bank called MergerTech. Also, 2014, he founded Cura Cannabis, which became the largest cannabis company in the U.S. at that time. Sold to Curaleaf for $948 million, largest M&A deal in cannabis history. Amazing stuff. Co-founded Sabre Fitness, a franchisee of Planet Fitness, who he later sold for $200 million. It just goes on and on. And currently managing his family office with significant investments in Goldflower Cannabis, El Cristiano Tequila, a health and wellness company called Arista, while also mentoring over 20 tech companies. Welcome to the Rainmakers Power Hour. And
you guys make me feel better about myself on a Tuesday than I feel on a Saturday. So thank you for that. Welcome.
So quite a list of accomplishments. So let's talk about your beginnings. You're 17. What motivated you to come to the U.S.? And tell us about the story of getting here and your journey.
It's quite a story. I actually came to the U.S. My dad was in the Indian Army, which in India is quite a prestigious profession, like 80,000 kids sit for the exam every 6 months, 1,500 get in. And then you've got to pass the physical exam, and 500 out of 80,000 are chosen every 6 months. It's the West Point equivalent. As an Indian kid of an Army officer, you get a bachelor's degree and get to try out quite a few things you wouldn't otherwise. So I came here on my summer vacation to visit my aunt in Chicago. I fell in love with football. Preseason football was happening, and this is 1988. I'd never seen anything like it. This is the true story of what actually brought me to the U.S. I went to the library, and I pulled out 4 books on football. So I applied to USC. I got into USC, went back home to get my visa, and I just couldn't get my visa because I'd come as a tourist. And while I was in the country, I became a student. And obviously, they didn't like that. But 10 days into the semester, having started, I got very lucky, got my visa at night in Delhi. My parents lived quite far away from there. The best my dad could manage in foreign currency exchange was $40. He put me on a plane that same night through Tokyo. And I got to Tokyo and had a layover. I spent those dollars on a pair of socks with the Japanese flag on them. As it turned out, the next day, it wasn't socks at all. It was a bandana. So I still had dirty socks and no money. And Northwest Airlines at the time, you can tell how far back the story goes, charge $24 to get into the US. And I think this is the beginning of my entrepreneurial story. The next three things that happened in a row, when I look back, I realize probably had the entrepreneur in me. I convinced the lady at the desk to basically pay the $24 or waive the $24. I don't know exactly how she put me on the plane. I get off the plane at LAX. I convince the bus driver with my two suitcases to take me to USC, and I don't have bus fare. I'm standing in line at the international student office, 10 days late to school. Guy behind me goes, "Oh, you're new to the school." He goes, "Where are you living?" And I'm like, "I have no idea." And he was Indian as well. He's like, "Why don't you live with us? You can figure it out." And then I got the lady at the desk to, you know, lend me $400 so my aunt from Chicago could Western Union at door. That's how I ended up in the country and at USC.
Well, that's quite a story. You're coming in hot, as they say. You finally, I mean, you're just like, "I know I'm going to make it. I'm just going to go and figure it out later." And we do hear that from a lot of entrepreneurs. You majored in industrial engineering, right?
Yeah.
That's your degree. But it's not necessarily what you ended up doing. So you moved on from Purdue, got your degree, and then tell us where you went from there.
Yeah, I started off as an accounting major because it was the only scholarship they had. I just looked around and said, "I'll take any subject, as you said, figure it out later." So I started off as an accounting major and then realized, of course, look at me, I would start off as a teacher at some point. And so Purdue was ranked number one in the country, and I got a scholarship to move there. So I moved to Purdue, undergrad and grad school there. And I actually got into the PhD program. 1 year into the PhD program, I'm like, what am I doing? I'm not thinking about what I want to do in the future. I'm just going down the academic track. And I realized that what I really wanted to do was start a business. At that point in the PhD program, I was 25. My brother had come to visit me. He was 20. I'm like, "What do you want to do?" He's like, "Well, I want to get an MBA. I'm like, "Why?" He goes, "Well, I think I'll make more money that way. I've been here for 4 or 5 years. I think the way you make more money is by starting a company." From that conversation, we ended up starting a software company. I was working for Oracle at the time, so we ended up starting an Oracle programming company. From that grew Saver Software eventually. So that's kind of how I made the shift from college into an entrepreneurship track. Very fortunate to say the only job I've ever had is founder or co-founder. Other than Taco Bell and 84 Lumber and all those jobs to get through college, Dunkin' Donuts, Subway, did it all. But, you know, since I've graduated, I've been very fortunate to be an entrepreneur and throughout my life. Some might not, and there are definitely moments in a day when you don't think it's that fortunate to be an entrepreneur as well. It's not all fun and games for sure.
Macy, it looked like you were trying to unlock you already.
My phone keeps going. It's so funny because I was going to ask you, and you kind of just touched on it a little bit, about college versus entrepreneur. If you had it to do over again, would you go straight into the entrepreneur path, or do you feel like the college experience was valuable for you?
Yeah, I think you read a lot about how the college experience these days is maybe more valuable in networking and who you get to know when you eventually graduate. I wasn't very social, actually. I was an extremely shy kid. I didn't really break out into being comfortable until I was about 32. So my college experience was very focused on academics and not a lot of socializing. I don't think that I personally would go into entrepreneurship. There's absolutely people who are brilliant and can make the jump and know what they want to do from a young age. In a minute, you know, when we come to it, I'll talk about the different kind of businesses you can run and what kind of people I think are well suited to not go to college. But for 95% of entrepreneurs who want to run a business, not Facebook, not Tesla, not an Elon Musk phone, you know, something that you have to invent, I think college provides rigor and some critical thinking that are possibly not available if you don't actually go to college. So I'd highly recommend it. On top of that, if you drink and party, I mean, I think that's a big... I didn't get to that till I was 39.
No, I was going to ask you because you said it was 1988 when you were over here looking at football. And you know who was on top of their game in the 80s for college football was Miami. Is that why you ended up in South Beach?
I ended up in South Beach just recently. I moved here August 10th of this year. Moving to South Beach was a function of the investment we have here in Goldflower, one of our cannabis companies. It's my second go around in cannabis. That company started 4 years ago and has finally hit a stride, opening a retail store every 20 days now and just accelerating beyond belief. We had 5 stores on June 1. We'll have 11 tomorrow. like 10 today. So one's opening tomorrow as well. So it in, and it's a vertically integrated system, which means we already also have, you know, well over 300,000 square feet of cultivation and manufacturing. So it's a large enterprise that I was advising on and investing from Oregon. Eventually, given my previous experience in cannabis, I thought I'd better move here and help get it to the next level, both for the team as well as for the investors.
So you were kind of an early adopter then, if you had a previous go around with cannabis.
Yeah, cannabis, interesting story. So it's 2014, Oregon had just legalized, second to Colorado. I'd already had the software exit. I was doing investment banking, as Wendy said, and I was really, the itch was there to put a high growth company together. The software company, when it exited, did like 59 million, 120 million, 300 million. We were growing very fast when we sold that to EDS. While we were selling to EDS, EDS was bought by HP. So eventually that transaction was closed with HP. But it took a couple of years. I had young kids and I was raising them. The investment banking stuff was great. At any one point in time, you were doing a couple of deals. But I'm like, I want to run a high growth company again. What got me into it was how many professional friends who smoke cannabis didn't want to get into cannabis. There was a huge amount of stigma in 2014. Lawyers, accountants, professionals didn't want to get into a cannabis company. And if it failed, they felt they couldn't get another job. I said, this is a real opportunity. The first person who put professional capital and a professional team together is going to be one of the winners. That was the thought I had in 2014. The second thought, when I looked at the landscape, was I was 42 at the time, and I'm like 52-year-old Nathan's really going to kick himself if I didn't get into the game when my family had no stigma about it. I'd already had an exit, so I didn't need outside capital. And so that's actually how I got into cannabis. Fortunate that that became eventually by 2018, the largest cannabis company in the country. By 21, we sold it for $948 million. Wendy, we actually tell it in Canadian terms. So it was a $1 billion exit in Canadian dollars, a week ago.
Amazing. I mean, simply amazing. I want to rewind a little bit. We'll get back to talking about Goldflower because I'm a fan of yours. We follow where you're going with your investments because we know how smart you are. Let's go back to starting that first company with Saber. You grew it to 1,200 employees. This is your first company and did a multi-million-dollar exit. How were you able to scale this so quickly? I mean, you literally had just graduated from college. Yes, your brother had an NDA at this point, but...
He didn't, because I stopped him from getting one. Instead of the MBA, despite me having said he should go to college, he did go to undergrad. He was 20. He had just arrived. I was 25. For those listening in talking about how you get started, critical partnerships are very difficult. If you've ever started a company with somebody, even somebody you love or a family member, it doesn't matter who you are. Having my brother, who was very close to me as a partner, is a core and critical part of the success. We have very different skill sets. And we literally started as two guys in a garage. And I think if any advice I could give, we first focused on getting financially healthy. So we didn't mind that the first year or two, we weren't building software to sell. We were just hiring consultants and winning contracts and building up a healthy income. While that income was coming in, when you look back at the success of any company, you have to find the inflection point. Some people call them luck. Some people call them opportunities. What happened to us is we were living in Oregon, and Oregon had already decided to create what is known as a centralized voter registration system. And if you remember Bush versus Gore that happened in 2000, part of the problem was hanging chads, but a significant problem was how confusing the ballots were. And I don't know how many of you remember back to that. So here we are sitting, Bush versus Gore happened. The federal government passes a law called the Help America Vote Act. And what it mandates is by 2006, every state must have a centralized voter registration system, which means the counties no longer control how the ballot looks. The state has a singular ballot and a single way of managing who's running for what office, where the election workers go. And one company in the country had a centralized voter registration system. And that was us. We won the next 12 contracts in a row. That's where the high growth came from. So we funded it from finding a source of income, which was consulting, and then funded the software side. That's when the company really exploded.
Amazing. You saw the opportunity and you took it. When you were doing your exit with Saber, what would you have done differently for building that company and exiting that company? There must have been something you wanted to change because you later started your own M&A company.
Yeah, actually, we started our own M&A company because of how incredible the M&A process was. We were a government software company, and we had $20 million in earnings, and we exited for almost, 24 times that, $480 million, $470 million was the actual number. And Goldman Sachs ran our process. What I learned during that process was how important contacts and relationships are. Goldman Sachs would never take on a project that small. We had, in the prior year, taken on an investment from a mezzanine fund by Accel and KKR. You cannot get two more premium names in finance. So KKR, the biggest LBO fund in the world, and Accel, known as the most premier VC fund, first investor in Facebook, had found a mezzanine fund, and we were one of their investments just a year prior. And they went and got the head of technology for Goldman Sachs to run this process. And I think he could have run it in his free time. When I was asked what I thought I could get for the company, I'm like, if we get $200 million, this would be beyond my wildest dreams. And how they ran the process was so incredible that I felt that I had learned something. And that's how I ended up mentoring 20 plus tech companies. I would invest in them and help them exit at multiples that were higher than one could have foreseen going in. What I would have done differently at Sabre, there are so many things, one might think you would do differently, but the year we sold it was just the year prior to the big global financial crash. So we sold it in 2007. I think the world came crashing down in 2008. We had a gut instinct for that. And I would highly recommend folks who are building companies, you've got to listen to your gut. Everybody on the board opposed the sale. Every single member. We had guys I was so afraid of even walking into the room with, George Roberts from KKR, the R of KKR, with Jim Breyer, the actual founder of Excel, who put money into Facebook, absolutely opposing me. They had invested at a $40 million valuation just 6 months before. I said, I think I want to sell this. I don't like what is happening. I don't like the macro picture. And that's when they said, if you get 100 to 80 for this company, we'll make four times our money in less than a year. We're out. We ended up getting $470 million. More than what we got wrong on the M&A side, it inspired me to go out and start MergerTech. And that's how MergerTech started. And it's the only company my bankers run. I haven't really managed to touch it in almost 10 years. But that experience with Goldman was so extraordinarily learning experience that I thought I had to get in there and do it again.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Credit, I do have a question.
Nitin, what do you look for when you are investing in new companies? What are some of the basic things that you look for that you would be like, you know what, I'm going to put money in there. What is it that you look for?
Here, maybe I'll start with a failure, because Wendy, you've been very kind about complimenting my successes. As large as the numbers there's been a $90 million failure, there's been a $36 million failure. But what I learned from them is you have to be very careful about industry selection. If you go to my website, I think, Wendy, I sent you the link. It may be pinned somewhere. The family office website, Kalimata.com, and that's just an Indian goddess's name, which is why I named it Kalimata. It lays out our thesis credit. And the parts of the thesis, of course, is what's going on in the world today. The first half of the thesis is, I think everybody is looking for individualized alternative medicine. We wrote that 5 years ago before Maha was a thing. Before Bobby Kennedy was a thing, literally wrote that thesis one night when my brother and I decided to start the family office, what we would invest in. You've got to have a world view. It may be crypto. It may be that people are looking for an alternative to pharmaceuticals. We had success in cannabis. So that naturally led us to that. In fact, the three companies, were the most invested in and are most hands-on with in terms of advisory is cannabis, tequila, and a wellness sanctuary, a physical wellness sanctuary. And from our perspective, all three help with health and wellness. And so, what we are looking for in today is what trends, and I'll tell, for example, psychedelics are legalizing faster than cannabis legalized. Why are people searching for anything from mushrooms to ketamine therapy to ayahuasca? I think it feeds into this broader trend we are investing in, which is individualized, alternative, personalized medicine. People wear trackers. People want to know what's going on with their own bodies, what's going into their bodies. And the way we play that trend, of course, is from our experience, which was cannabis. Turns out for us in Goldflower, cannabis turned out to be the next cannabis itself. But tequila for us, and people ask me, how does that fit into health and wellness? And, We've talked about loneliness, the social epidemic, and I think tequila helps people get out and behind other devices and into talking with each other. We promote a healthy version of it and a healthy way to consume it. That's our mindset about what we invest in. It has to be something that helps people with physical, social, emotional solutions for what they're searching for that aren't provided by big pharma, big tobacco, big alcohol.
Well, I think that we tasted your tequila at the jet party. Am I correct? It was so delicious and so pure. I live in Vegas, so I thought you need to know. We do all the spirits and all the drinks and Wendy's here and Rhett's here and so forth. So just amazing that you have gone to other verticals that create interest for you. I think after you make a certain amount of money in your life, you now want to be able to have a higher quality of life. Yes. And at the same time, I come from a third world country, which is Vietnam, and I have gone back to that country to give them a viewpoint that they don't have because they're trapped in that little world. Do you do anything like that where you're going back to India, speaking to the young youth or the entrepreneurial and giving them insight on that worldview that you talk about?
Credit you. You made an amazing connection that you may have intended to or not, but the way we give back is through the tequila. The reason we don't go back to India is I talked about my visa issues when I first got here, and I couldn't go back to India for years, so I would go to Mexico. El Cristiano, which is our tequila, is actually a passion project that is an homage to the country of Mexico. It's called El Cristiano because Mexico is a 93% Catholic country, right? Everything about it is for us to honor Mexico. The three legs of the stool that the tequila stands on are called purity, which you just referenced, passion, which I just referenced. But the third thing is purpose. The purpose of El Cristiano is to give back to the communities that create tequila. You know, over the last decade or two, there's been sustainable coffee and sustainable cigar leaves. And people who are coming from farming communities or products that come from farms are going back and ensuring that the communities are healthy, not just the agriculture is healthy. And so we wanted to do that for tequila. So we provide funding and training and help to all the orphanages in the highlands of tequila. The town that is the capital of the highlands of Jalisco is called Arandas. So every orphanage there is supported by us. The other half, the purpose, is also supporting the women, right? So women and children is how we give back. So in our distillery, it is 100% female workforce. When you get out of the farm and you pick up that plant and you take it and the doors of the distillery open, the last male person allowed is the truck driver who drops off the agave. And because we found that even if you don't have it all female in the supervisory chain, especially in the third world country, you can end up in a lot of issues as well. So what we've been doing now for about 7 years since we started the company is enabling that sustainability of that community through women and children.
That is so inspiring. I love passion projects. You obviously have a lot of passion. I want to get back to your business insights because you've been extremely successful. You have some sort of parameter that you use. You talked about what you're looking for to start in an industry or a profession and the need, like DMT and psychedelics. We've seen a lot of that recently come up as far as it's starting to become more legal here in the U.S. So I absolutely appreciate the path forward where you like to be an early adopter. That are things that are coming, deregulated things, is what other parameters do you look for when you're looking to jump into either an industry or within that industry to start a business? What parameters do you look for?
Having been successful in gyms, tequila, cannabis, and software, what I look for when starting a project and the advice I would give entrepreneurs, abstracted. I don't look for industries at first. The abstraction I look for is in this industry, do I have a team or do I myself have the ability to do three things? This is how I manage my business every day from the day I started to the finish. That's clarity. I think the single biggest benefit an entrepreneur can give themselves, everybody who invests in, is extremely clear-headed thinking. Are you thinking about the problem clearly? Are you thinking about the solution clearly? Are you hanging on to hopes and dreams, or are you actually looking at the world as it is? And what I find in most executives, especially executives who come to us from larger companies, is they jump to the third part. I would say the first is clarity. Once you've figured out what it is that you got to do, the second is prioritization. when I mentor folks, Wendy talked about how many CEOs I mentor. I first move to this part. Is the CEO thinking clearly, whether it's an HR issue, whether it's an industry issue, whether it's where to deploy the capital next issue, whether it's should I grow or should I focus on profitability? Are you actually thinking about this? And does it actually meet your strategic goals or your personal goals why you started the company? The next, once you've thought through it, are you prioritizing which things you tackle first and which things you let someone else tackle? And the third is execution. And what I find, especially in the US, which is a very hard charging culture, is we all get to work. We get there in the morning and we begin with execution. And so from the beginning, when I look at something, I'm like, is this a problem worth solving? Second, are we the right team to solve it? I think answering that question is critical. Why are we the right people? Because the first time you go out to fundraise, a VC is going to ask, why is your team well suited? And that's a very good question. It is a critical question you should ask yourself. When folks jump into entrepreneurship, it's very difficult, as I'm sure you've heard, you know, from every entrepreneur, you know, laying awake at nights thinking, where's the money going to come from or where the success is going to come from? So I try to make sure that I and those around me for that specific industry have an ability to think clearly, to prioritize our issues, and then to execute. And the way I help folks move up the chain is for those execs, those of my CEOs that I mentor that I don't see focusing on the first two, I take their calendar and I put an hour every single day on their calendar. It simply says, put your feet up on the table, close your eyes. We're not thinking nearly enough. For myself, this is what I do for every company. Every morning I wake up for a full hour for each of these three companies you heard about. I spend half an hour thinking about what could kill me and half an hour thinking about what could grow me 2x to 10x. Is there an opportunity out there? If you have a great team, that's the benefit. They are handling the prioritization and the execution. You can move yourself up to that very top of the strategy chain, which is, as I just said, making sure you're handling the threats and opportunities at the very highest level.
I love that Kaizen approach. I think that is a phenomenal approach. And one of the questions I really wanted to ask you, because you talked about a minute ago, are we the right team? But you didn't talk about how. And what I wanted to know from you specifically is because you are a rock star at the entrance. Some people get lucky and have a great product or it just takes off and they get a great exit. But you have done it over and over again. You've done it in a lot of industries where you're an early adopter, we just talked about. So you don't have a business model. I want to talk about your business models for a little bit, because obviously you had a very successful gym exit. You had a business model, I'm assuming, with Planet Fitness, right? You were an extension or a branch or a sister yep. company to them. So you had a business model that made a lot of sense. High quantity, hope they don't show up, low entry point for the consumer, and just let it roll on auto. You had that, but you've also had to develop your own business model for industries that were up and coming. So how do you sit down and develop a successful business model? Do you
have a strategy? That's a fantastic point. That is a fantastic question and something we think about. I think I mentioned this earlier that we're going to talk about this hopefully a little bit later. Picking the company or picking the industry and what to do inside that industry is such a crucial question. I think it may be the most crucial question that the CEO is tasked with answering. What industry are we entering? What part of that industry are we attacking? And the way we go about it, Macy, always has been, it's changed over my career. When you first start off, I think there are three types of businesses in my mind, at least. There's B2B businesses where you create a product or service, you sell it to another business. That's well known. There's a B2C business, which is significantly harder, rising above the consumer noise, how to market to a consumer, requires a lot more capital, especially when TV advertising doesn't work. Everybody's got an influence. And then there's a third kind of business model that not a lot of people talk about, which is what I call the genius mindset business model, which requires the most capital of all. Sam Altman at OpenAI, Musk at Tesla, or SpaceX. These are guys sitting around saying, I want to put a rocket in the moon every day. So I think if you're 25 and you start off with a SpaceX or Tesla kind of business model, you better be that kind of genius that can find that kind of capital and talent around you. It does become easier to move from B2B to B2C. So I've always tried to look around me and say, who's my team? what kind of resources, and I, for that I specifically need capital, I can get together for this project. And that's how we pick whether we should go into something. It's somewhat a capital allocator's mindset, but it's also a very HR-driven mindset. And I don't think I've touched on that enough here. Every success we've had, I know you guys have said a lot of complimentary things about me, is the team. In fact, the team that is running my companies today, why we can have these companies more as investments and still be hands-on, is it's the same team that's run my last companies. And so that means we've treated the people right and the people have treated us right, right? We sell a company and most of my executive team moves on over and over again. That same executive team has had failures and successes, which means, you know, you've got to be able to trust on the people. And it, like I said, it started with my brother, but the capital we can get together is not enough. What did they say? You know, 90% of the companies that failed could have succeeded. They just ran out of capital. So you have to be, that goes back to that critical thinking, that clarity of thinking. To be an entrepreneur, have to jump off a cliff. There's no doubt about that. And I'm not saying that sometimes you jump off with no plan and no parachute. The better you're thinking about where you will find that parachute, and how you might land, you know, in a bed of flowers and stuff in a concrete rock does help, you know, as you get along your way.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I love that you're giving us all of the secrets to your success, and we appreciate you being here today. I do want to open it up to some questions for the audience, because we have a nice audience here on Chatter tonight. Rhett, I don't know if you're hoping to ask the first question.
When I listen to our guests or your guests in the show, I start to feel kind of less than, because you think you're intelligent and then you hear somebody like Newton or Dr. Wagner talk, the insight to start from nothing and develop this is such a cool story. I've known Newton personally and I didn't realize he was this intelligent.
Now I got to look at this little cover.
We're going to be investing even more.
Partake. We have links up, right? So we can go on to his website, his tequila and his perfect.
Yeah. Cristiano's one of the best tequilas I've ever had. But I tell you what, Wendy and I are investors in Newton's projects. And if you go look at the project in Florida and see how they go about everything, it's unbelievably cool. It's like the Louis Vuitton of cannabis. The stores are, you look like you're going into a luxury store I don't do gummies or smoke, but it made me want to try it. I'm fascinated with the story. I didn't know a lot of that stuff, but it is impressive how you work with your brother so well. It's difficult to work with family members to make things. You have a great team around you, and you are right. They work well together, but they appreciate what you've done for them. And I think what people should take out of that when they start companies is to make sure you treat people right and get rid of the ones that bring you down. You got to keep the rest. It was a lot of knowledge about how to start as an entrepreneur.
Thank you, Red. Actually, you said something that I think is critical. You know, I think the wisdom on how well I work with my brother actually goes to him when he first came to the States. And this is a story about co-founders. And I've thought about this a lot. Current angel funds, current VC funds place a lot of emphasis on co-founders and not being a solitary founder. And yet, when you look at Bill Gates or Elon Musk or Larry Ellison or Steve Jobs, it's not necessarily a co-founder story. What I advise the CEOs I talk to is absolutely have co-founders. You need a business guy, you need a tech guy, but there has to be a hierarchy. The wisdom here came from my brother. When we started, we agreed from that point forward, any company, and by the way, you referenced the gyms, he actually ran that company, start to finish. I was completely passive in the gym business. We would be equal partners, but there has to be a hierarchy. And what he said was, Nitin, look, there's only one captain of the ship and you're that captain. It doesn't mean the other person does. It just made everything easier when it gets to that super hard spot. And that one sentence that he said at age 20 has made the subsequent 30 years so easy. Because if we get into a bind and you got to sail out of that storm, somebody has to make the call. And at that point, you walk out of the room and whether you agree or disagree, you've got to be on the same page. That's how we worked out of really tricky and difficult situations. You know, it helps if you have an incredible personal relationship. But I think back to all these times where a statement or a single comment or a single thing, you know, really changed the course of how we think about our future. And so that's what I would recommend. If you have a co-founder, you've got to sit down and figure out who is. NFL teams don't have two head coaches. There is a captain. You've got to figure out who that is. I see too many people flail about trying to feel that each person has an equal voice. You have an equal voice all the way up until a decision's made. And at that point, there's only one decision. This is how I relay the story of partnerships and co-founding.
I love it. I do know that Sal Pietro has his hand raised. Go ahead, Sal. You can unmic. Fellow Miami guy.
How's everybody doing?
Doing great, Sal. Thank you for being here. He was one of our guests, by the way.
Hi, Sal.
It is absolutely amazing. I had the pleasure of having lunch with him. If you think getting him here is good, you got to imagine having a one-on-one with him. He doesn't realize how many nuggets he drops when he talks. You need to write a book. Honestly, you're dropping so much gold and paying it forward to other entrepreneurs. It's pretty amazing. But I wanted to speak to something that came up when we were together, and I want you to elaborate a little bit about it. One of the things he was telling me when we were together, he was talking about his brand and why it's so important to him to have the right partners. And in the way that I mean by partners, like spokespeople. Like right now, cannabis is very hot. Every celebrity, every person wants to endorse it, wants to be about it. And he went into detail why he chooses certain partners and their backgrounds and some of the things that they had to fight early on in their careers, professional athletes. Would you like to talk a little bit about it? Instead of using what's hot now, really believing about the story behind them that you wanted to bring them forward.
Thank you for the kind words. If you went to the Gold Flowers website, you'd see brands like Ricky Williams, you know, ex-Heisman Trophy winner, ex-Dolphin, his brands on our site, Lion Order, which is a brand actually made up of Ray Lewis, Michael Phelps, Warren Sapp, Mike James, you know, a lot of folks who are athletes, NFL player and a swimmer. We have a Method Man from the Wu-Tang Clan. And I think, you know, what Sal and I were talking about is if you look from the outside, it would be like, wow, these guys sign up all these celebrities. And that's actually not true at all. What Gold Flower stands for is a company that really treats our mission statement ends with reverence for patients, the plant, and our own people. And that way the reverence comes about in our brand architecture is everybody who's signed with us has paid a professional sacrifice for advocating for cannabis that goes back at least two decades. Ricky Williams, one of the first people kicked out of the NFL for standing up for cannabis in 2004. Method Man dropped an album in 1991 called Tikal, taking into consideration all lives at the intersection of athleisure, which sounds so modern, but he talked about in 91, cannabis and music. And you talk about the Lion Order folks, and the key spokesperson for Lion Order is Rowan Marley, Bob Marley's son, big South Florida voice. So we looked at our architecture and said, how can we let people know that we are actually supporting those who are truly advocating for and have paid a price for speaking out in defense of cannabis? And that's kind of how we, and I won't name the celebrities we've turned down, but as you can imagine, we have a lot of them. Brett was in the room when Ricky Williams stood up on a chair, gave a 20-minute speech about how we were the youngest company. At that point, we had one store when Ricky signed with us, and a competitor, the largest one in the state, had 162 stores. He gave a speech to our investors 2 years ago, and he said, I've been smoking cannabis for 40 years. It's the greatest cannabis I've ever smoked. If you go to Gold Flower and buy my cannabis, it's grown in the most favorable way. So it goes both ways. There's a respect from us towards our brand partner, and there's a tremendous amount of respect from them having hand-selected us, because Florida's a unique place. Any other place you can go, you can buy Ricky's brand, which is called Heisman, in every store in Oregon. But when in Florida regulatory system, once he signs with us, you can't buy that brand in any other store except Gold Flower. They are choosing us because we are dedicated to the art and craft of providing super clean cannabis to our patients.
100%. I've been to the facility. I did the tour. It's absolutely incredible.
Wendy, I've heard so many amazing things. You and Rhett both talked about it. It's by far head and shoulders above any other brand that's out there from my understanding. Congratulations for that. Yes. On another note, I am curious, are you active in lobbying for changes in the drug testing situation? Because that's a huge hindrance. If you're looking at the industry as a whole, the testing hasn't caught up to the laws and policies and procedures. And that's a really big stumbling block for a lot of people to enter the market as a consumer. So you've got it now legal in the state of Florida and California. As a business owner, I have employees that I am forced to drug test in both of those states before allowing them to go on certain projects and job sites. I just had drug tests yesterday, actually. How are you lobbying for it? I guess what I'm asking is, it would really be your catchment of your consumer would be a lot larger if we could go to a breathalyzer style testing system like what we do with alcohol. It is legal and people doing it on their own time. They should not be forced out of work because it's still in their system 30 days later. That's one thing I want to know. Another thing is, I looked into getting the breathalyzer form of testing for cannabis, and it's quite cumbersome. It takes forever and it's quite expensive. If you happen to want to go in another industry, I feel like that's going to take off.
Huge.
Because all the laws are changing to make it legal, but company policy is, if it's in your urine sample, you're fired. We haven't caught up, and the testing is really a huge hindrance. I just thought, if somebody could develop a breathalyzer style test that's not cumbersome and it's not $3,500 a test, talking about $1 billion idea, that would be it.
It is very, very difficult. I don't know if you caught Sean Duffy, who's the cabinet secretary in charge of Department of Transportation, yesterday on Fox, talking about the fact that while he does believe President Trump is going to reschedule cannabis, he's worried about it from his own job standpoint, which is transportation. How do you appropriately, because, you know, it's easy to detect alcohol. It's very, very difficult. And you're right. It's a very complicated problem. It's further complicated by the fact that a lot of people, as in Florida, which is a medical-only state, do in fact use it for medicine. And there's this myth out there, and I think most people believe this who don't consume cannabis, that medical is just another way of consuming it recreationally. It's a drug, but you go and get your medical card. And that's not what we find at all. I come from my previous company from pure recreational states, Oregon, Nevada, Arizona, and California, where it was fully legalized recreationally. And now we come to Florida and we find 80, 90% of our patients are walking in saying, I have cancer, I can't sleep. You know, I'm a blue collar worker. And after a lifetime of doing it, my knees don't work, my elbows don't work, my hips don't work. Over and over again, we also see it from the way it's consumed. In, just by example, California and Oregon, 20% of the consumption is through gummies. In Florida, it's only 3%. Most of the consumption is through something called dabbing, which is a way of consuming it without eating 1,000 pounds of sugar or smoking, either of which a cancer patient can do. People use it for hunger if you've got cancer as well. What do you do when you stop somebody and they're like, well, but I'm a patient, or they're working and they say, well, I've got a doctor's note, which in Florida, every single person has a prescription from a doctor that's refilled every 35 days. I don't think people realize how regulated it is in Florida. Every 30 days, you get your prescription refilled. And if it's not enough, you have to go back to the doctor and say, I need 5 grams instead of 4 grams. It's not working, or I'm consuming it too much. What do you do in that instance where now it's medicine? It is a very complicated topic, given the complexity of everything from tax and banking and the federal legalization. We tend to stay away from advocating any position, but rather try to understand the position of the regulatory system of that state and then follow it as closely as we can. For example, last year in Florida, it was on the ballot to move it from medical to recreational. Would be hugely beneficial for our business. We didn't advocate for it one way or another. We look at it as, it's been 12 years of everybody telling the government what to do, and they do it at their own speed. But what we do is, we are on the charitable side. We talked about the tequila company at Gold Flower. We're launching something called Freedom Roll. And Freedom Roll is 100% of the profits of this pre-roll, 1 month will go to a charity that helps low-level, nonviolent marijuana offenders get out of jail. That's what the charity does. 100% of the profits will go to Army veterans who are looking for cannabis as a medical solution. So we were looking how we could help, and we just couldn't find a way in the regulated system. You're not allowed to advertise. In Florida, you can't put up a billboard and say, we want to help veterans. So we worked with the government. So I went to Tallahassee and I said, how could we do this? How can it be that we can't help these two charities? That's where the government worked with us. It took us 5 or 6 months. And they're like, well, I'm like, what if I just launched a project, took a percentage of our product that grows and just dedicated it? And they love that. So it's launching next month, actually. It's called Freedom Roll because it helps. It's a good name for both those charities. We go to the level of where we think we can make an impact and a difference, because we've seen how much dollars fall on both sides of the fence of what you're talking about, and nothing really shifts.
Sorry, Macy. I know we're running out of time, and Nelson Apega has a question, and I know Let's see. It was Ether. Yes. So we'll do those two. And I know, Nigel, I wanted to ask you something too. Everybody has a question for you, Nick, but I get to be respectful of your time. Go ahead, Nelson.
Thank you so much, Wendy. Thank you, Macy. This has been the best live podcast ever.
Oh, my.
I want to take a second to say thank you. This has been a powerful conversation. The clarity, conviction, and the humility you've brought to every answer are rare and inspiring. My question for you is this. When you look back over your entire entrepreneurial journey through the wins, the chaos, and the moments no one saw, what was the point that tested you the most? The moment that made you question everything and ultimately shaped who you are today?
Yeah, Nelson, first of all, thank you extremely for the kind words. You guys are making me blush repeatedly. I hope my lighting shows it. I'm actually warm in the cheeks after that comment because it truly is my environment going back to my young childhood that I feel has been responsible for so much of the success. The gut check, Nelson, believe it or not, was more recent. 3 years ago, we were in the middle of COVID. We had just deployed $55 million to Goldflower, eventually deploying $120 million in this business. And we deployed about $20 million into the tequila company. My mom called from India and she goes, I have cancer. And I just knew it the way she said it. It was really bad. We found a way to get her here. In COVID, all U.S. doctors refused treatment. And we were, of course, going to try for everything. We took her to Tijuana, Mexico, where they were trying lots of experimental stuff. And you look at this. You've got, at that point, $55 million in cannabis, of which 30 is from investors. You've got $20 million of your own money in the tequila where we don't really have investors. You're looking at your responsibilities and asking yourself where you belong. And the answer was we took our mom to Tijuana for 2 months. And every night you had to think if you were doing the right thing by everybody. Kids back here in Portland, Oregon, my brother's kids in LA, were living as if we were small kids with my mom and dad in a small, tiny hospital room. You know, we talk about treating people right. That's where it came through. My management team, which had been with me for multiple prior companies, came through where I could take 2 months off. And these businesses both required active capital. So we're deploying capital actively while we're taking care of my mom. When my mom passed, I was in really bad shape mentally and emotionally for another 9 months. So this is an 11-month saga where you're not able to focus. You're not able to look, you know, an investor in the eye and say you've got 100% that you're giving. And had it not been for treating people right throughout your life, I don't know if we would have pulled through these, you know, through this very difficult time.
Wow. Thank you so much. That's great.
Thank you for the question.
Great question, Nelson. Ether, I know you've been waiting a long time. It is your turn.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. And if I can pile on with a couple more accolades, I'll just do that. There's a reason for you blushing, and that's because you have been going through an explanation of your origins and your trajectory. To me, it comes across as very humble. And that is clearly recognized in the story you just reflected with your mother as well. Let me just say this. As I'm listening to your origin story as an immigrant myself, and we just heard from another immigrant, Nelson, you also likewise have that immigrant story coming as a visitor, coming as a student, and going through those challenges. Now, as we look back at this trajectory with the lessons that you learned in business, economics, investing, and in this environment that we're in, living in right now, and I'm not looking at it from a political perspective, but from an economic and business perspective, it is very clear that there's an emerging sense that immigration itself is at times a threat. What is your sense of this and your feeling about this from a business standpoint, from an economic standpoint, and from an investor standpoint, the pushback that some societies are giving to immigration and the contributions you've made as an immigrant to this society? Thank you very much for your story. I really appreciate it. This is Ether signing out. Thank you.
Thank you. A difficult question. We'll leave the politics to the politicians to respond to, whichever side you may fall on. But I tend to look at this as an inflection point, not only from the changes in immigration, but you look at it in China, we're undergoing this massive change. Industries are going to lose and certain industries are going to win. I think you bring up a critical point, which we didn't touch on earlier, as you know, Macy asked me how I think of an investment. I think you've got to abstract it even further now and say, what environment do I trust the future will hold? Will immigrants be allowed to work there? And if not, do I have the kind of company that withstands that? For us, we're looking at those three big things, immigration, AI, and China, as things that could make massive changes to how we live our lives. I tend not to think of it personally. I tend not to think of, oh my goodness, if you know immigration laws change, somebody like myself won't have been able to come here. It's kind of like Macy's question about trying to convince politicians. It's very hard to do that. We can only make decisions mostly with the hands we're dealt. That goes back to what I was talking about in the clarity. I tend to deal with seeing where the world's headed. So when I talk to my kids, I've got four kids from 23 to 8. You're talking to them every day about things that were so relevant 2 years ago. AI is going to now eat that job. China did work that we did with our hands 40 years ago. AI is going to do the work. Imagine telling your kid that all the stuff your parents told you, law, science, medicine, marketing, it's just all going to be handled by AI, not even by an immigrant kid, which I think 5 years ago was a fear that maybe an immigrant kid is going to take your job. Now we don't even need the immigrant kid to take your job. A computer is going to take your job and going to take it fast. And so from an investment standpoint, we've invested in hard consumer products. Nobody can take the job of making and selling really good tequila or really good weed. So there is a thesis behind our thinking, and thanks for surfacing that, that I don't think I'd fully explained how it ties into where the world is today.
Great question there. I hope you have time for one more. Nigel is our tech guy, and he gives to us every week. Thank you, Nigel, and you have the mic.
Thank you. I'll keep it brief. Thank you, Lynn, for joining us. My question is this. I loved your opening statement and the emphasis on health and wellness. That's in your thesis. And I agree that physical and emotional health are the key drivers to life. I know in your investment portfolio that you have ventures focused on health and wellness. And so I'm also building a venture that is focused on developing and deploying the next generation of entrepreneurs into the ecosystem. Our verticals are creative strategy and founder development with health and wellness integration. My question is this, when it comes to making an investment, how important is it not just that the venture is focused on health and wellness, but that founder is exemplifying emotionally, mentally, spiritually, socially, physically healthy? I often find to say, I don't just invest in the venture, but I also invest in the entrepreneur. Well, I would love you.
I would flip it and say early stage investing is almost 100% about the entrepreneur. When I talk about the tech companies that I mentor, those are my investments that we don't have an operational role in. Every single company will go through so many changes before it arrives at where it needs to arrive that the only person who can get it there are the founders or the founder. And dealing with, you know, the setbacks, taking advantage of the opportunities. And so I think the point you were bringing up is more than 100% right. I am almost exclusively an entrepreneur investor, and rarely in that case when I'm investing with somebody else, whether it's crypto or last Friday we invested in a quantum computing company. I barely understand it. But Manish, the founder, was just brilliant. You could tell there's a passion, you know, he thinks about it 24/7. And so we were lucky to invest in a crypto company 10 years ago called Circle that just returned, I think, 900x when it went public. I totally forgot I'd even just had met the founder. I'm like, this guy is going places. I came upon the side of physical fitness much later in my life, and I wish I'd come upon it sooner. I think it's a critical angle. Since I started working out, I'm 54 now, about 6 years ago. I had never really worked out or even thought about it until I was 48. I mean, it's brought focus and clarity. I couldn't agree with you more as to your thesis of investing in the founder. And if they're not there yet, helping them get there on the emotional side. When I'm talking to people, I'm asking about their marriages, their health and fitness routine, and how they get happiness and so on. And it's become more important almost in the technical job of mentoring them on how to be a CEO, is getting them mentally there to do the work of being a CEO.
Yeah, great question, Nigel, and thank you. Well, listen, Nitin, thank you so much for joining us. You have been just amazing tonight. We appreciate the plethora of success points that you've given us, all the nuggets, and we cannot even thank you enough for being part of our podcast. So I know that you've got to get back to the wife and four children. Thank you again for being with us tonight.
Thank you. You all are way too kind. I really appreciate the extremely warm sentiments and the warm welcome. I look forward to meeting you and Nigelon and Nelson and everybody. Brett, hopefully I'll see you soon. I've made a lot of good friends through just the thought of moving to South Florida, and thank you for this platform.
Thank you. And hey, Stephanie just sent us a rocket chat. I did want to get a photo, so really keep your eyes open for a second. All right. You have a great night, and thank you so much.
It's been a lot of fun. Hopefully it's been valuable. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you to our audience, and thank you to our tech team for helping us every single week, and our sponsor, William and Harry. Bye, guys. See you next week. Bye-bye.